on stage by Anna Quinlan, one of my favorite authors. I was asked to, forced to, join Twitter, which I dreaded at first, but have come to mostly enjoy. I figured doing interviews would be the least revelatory experience since I was used to those, but in subtle ways, I found the same "who helped you" tone was back once again. The biggest example of this was an interview I did with a national newspaper. For starters, the journalist came to the interview a bit gruff. He didn't seem particularly familiar with my work or generally psyched to be there. It was a lunch interview, and he seemed annoyed at having to order something. I decided that I'd win him over with my sparkling personality. This is a very bad way to start an interview. You are not there to entertain like a clown at a kid's birthday party. Actually, maybe that's not a bad analogy. This party was about to turn a little scary and maybe even end in tears. The interview was conducted more like a scene from Law and Order in which I was the perp and he was trying to trap me into making a confession. He opened up his notebook and methodically went down his list of questions. "On page 9 of your book, Franny has trouble with her curly hair." I read that you've had trouble with your curly hair. Yeah, well, a bad hair day is sort of something many women can relate. "On page 11, Franny waitresses. Have you ever waitressed?" "Yes, many actors when they're starting out." "On page 39, Franny has an audition that doesn't go well. Have you ever had an audition that didn't go well?" "Yes, well, it's a book about a girl who wants..." "Fine, I did it, okay? Just handcuff me now." Fairly quickly, I began to feel he'd written the article before I ever showed up. I don't mean this literally, but he might as well have. He'd decided that my fiction was nothing more than a bunch of thinly veiled diary entries and therefore deemed it unworthy, not real writing. I could have just stayed home in my pajamas. I didn't need him to pat me on the head and tell me I'd done a good job. I didn't even need him to like what I'd written. But this wasn't supposed to be an article reviewing the book. This was supposed to be an article about the process and how the book came to be, and I found it strange that he'd come prepared mostly to dismiss the accomplishment itself. "Thanks for doing this," I sing-songed in an overly cheery tone as he left. "Don't thank me until you've read it," he grumbled over his shoulder. What was it I'd encountered that day and those other times? Why would anyone assume I'd need help with or take credit for something that wasn't my work? Was it sexism? In my Hollywood life, the sexism is so rampant that it's easy to spot. Every single feature film I've ever done was directed by a man, for example. Women who are hotter than me get parts I'm up for all the time. What am I going to do, sue the Screen Actors Guild because I'm not Megan Fox? It is what it is. I do what I can to affect change within the system. But this brand of condescension was something new and seemed woman-specific somehow. Maybe it had to do with being an actress, a job some people think is full of pretty dum-dums. Male actors don't seem to face the same bias. Even though my former boss, Ron Howard, practically grew up on sets when he was first starting out as a director, I doubt anyone ever asked who helped him direct Tom Hanks in Splash. In contrast, a few months after the book was published, I got word that Ellen DeGeneres' production company, AVGP, wanted to option it for television. There were discussions about who should write the script. Some advised me to stay open to suggestions that to give the book its best shot at being made into a TV show, it should probably be adapted by someone who'd actually written a TV script before. This made complete sense to me. But when I sat down with Ellen and her producing partner, Jeff Kleeman, and asked whom they were thinking of to do the adaptation, they looked at me funny. "You," they said, like it was the most obvious answer. That one word opened so many doors. Now, that script was a delight to work on, but it didn't get picked up at the CW, so both opinions about who should write it probably had merit. But that experience led to a chance to write a pilot the next year, and that led to a feature agent at my agency taking an interest in me, which led to the opportunity to adapt the book, The Royal We, with my producing partner and husband, Mae Whitman. When Mae and I went to pitch the book to Terry Press, the head of CBS Films, Terry looked at me and said, "Who's going to write it, you?" I nodded, and she said, "Okay," giving me another first chance to do something I'd never done before. I guess what I'm saying is, let's keep lifting each other up. It's not lost on me that two of the biggest opportunities I've had to break into the next level were given to me by successful women in positions of power. If I'm ever in that position and you ask me who, I'll do my best to say you, too. But in order to get there, you may have to break down the walls of whatever it is that's holding you back first. Ignore the doubt. It's not your friend. And just keep going, keep going, keep going. Oh, and in case you were wondering, writing Someday, Someday, Maybe in the first place led to the book you're listening to right now. And all of those other writing assignments, plus the filming of Gilmore Girls: A Year in the Life, are why the next novel is taking so long. But don't worry. In the meantime, you can pre-order my next book, Monkey Doodles, coming soon to a store near you. Kitchen Timer. Later in this book, I'll tell you about the many wonders of returning to Gilmore Girls, but here's an early example of the kind of mysterious and magical thing that sometimes occurred during the filming of the reboot. This time last year, I was an unemployed actor who'd recently said goodbye to a TV show. There's always a confusing transition when a show ends, especially one as enjoyable as parenthood. The end of any job, especially a long-running one, puts you in a kind of fog. I wandered around, having trouble making simple decisions like, should I work out first today or drop off the dry cleaning? Dry cleaning first, right? Yeah, that's the way people normally, no, maybe work out first? You go from having your days completely regimented to everything suddenly being up to you, and it's jarring. I wondered about things my brain hadn't had time to ponder while working, like how people do that thing with their hands where they connect their fingertips in a way that makes the heart shape. You know that thing? It's in ads and on book covers. Hi, Sarah Dessen. And in commercials, and everyone knows about it, right? Well, no one did that when I was growing up. I never saw it before, say, the last 10 years. Maybe it just wasn't a thing where I lived, but I'm pretty sure no one I knew anywhere did it. Could it be possible we've been on the planet this long and yet we only just thought of it? And if so, what took us so long? Doesn't this deep thought just blow your mind? Now you have something to talk about at the dinner table tonight. The problem is that this kind of ungrounded period isn't great if you have, say, a writing assignment or three you're supposed to be working on. I was inching toward the finish line on a few things when I really needed to be footing or miling it in that direction. Instead, my mind meandered over topics such as, do you ever wonder why people in Los Angeles cross the street so slowly, but people in New York City always sort of jog run? But life can't stay a Seinfeld rerun forever. Eventually, whether you're ready or not, limbo comes to an end because you must meet the deadline, or you have to get back to work, or at the very least, because the aimless wandering phase is replaced by another actor favorite, the it's over, it's all over, I'll never work again phase. But as Gilmore Girls: A Year in the Life began, there was suddenly a pileup of due dates the likes of which I'd never experienced before. First, without much notice, I was back to filming, and not those cushy parenthood hours either. I wasn't sleeping in a bison carcass like Leo or anything, but I had suddenly returned to a very heavy workload. Obviously, this book was due, not to mention the book that was due before this book was due. Then May and I sold The Royal We, and now that script was due, too. I wished I could get back all the days I'd spent looking at vintage tile tables on Cherish and weighing the pros and cons of what time of day to drop off dry cleaning. Back then, I'd had too much time on my hands. Now I had too little. One morning in the makeup trailer, I was talking to Dan Bukatinski, who plays Jim Nelson, the real-life editor of GQ magazine, in the show. He's also a screenwriter, and his book, Does This Baby Make Me Look Straight, is a hilarious and heartfelt memoir about adoption and being a gay dad. For a while, we just dished and shared writer woes. I talked about the various projects I was juggling and my worry over making my deadlines. Then I said something out loud that I'd never quite articulated before. I know I'll get them done. I just really wish I had a less painful process. Dan dipped his chin down to peer at me over his glasses. Lauren, he said, in a tone that also meant, please, call Dawn. Remember Dawn Roos and MYOB, the show I was on when I first got Gilmore Girls? Dawn Roos, the creator of Web Therapy, the writer of the screenplays Marley and Me and Happy Endings and Boys on the Side. Well, Dawn and Dan happened to be married. Don is funny and smart, and I admire his work, and he's been a successful screenwriter for a long time. He must be doing something right. So I called him, figuring at the very least we'd have a fun lunch, even if he couldn't help with my procrastination problems. I could have easily spent months and years staring at blank documents and staying up all night as I trial and errored my way through a few finished pages and many more images of vintage tile tables. But in the magical way that things just kept falling into place over the course of returning to the show, my question was answered on the very first try. I had lunch with Don, and he explained his way of working to me, a method that's been so effective he actually wrote it up to give to the many writers he mentors. It's his variation of the Pomodoro technique, called Kitchen Timer, and it's transformed the way I write. I now spend fewer hours being way more productive. It gave me structure where there was none. It has changed my life as a writer, and I hope it changes yours too. I love it so much that it makes me want to touch my fingertips together in that wonderful symbol we just invented in the last decade. But seriously, what took us so long? Kitchen Timer. The principle of Kitchen Timer is that every writer deserves a definite and doable way of being and feeling successful every day. To do this, we learn to judge ourselves on behavior rather than content. We set up a goal for ourselves as writers that is easy, measurable, free of anxiety, and above all, fail-proof, because everyone can sit, and an hour will always pass. Here's how it works. 1. Buy a kitchen timer, one that goes to 60 minutes, or use a timer app, or tell Siri to start a timer for 60 minutes. 2. We decide on Monday how many hours of writing we will do Tuesday. When in doubt or under pressure or self-attack, we choose fewer hours rather than more. A good, strong beginning is 1 hour a day, but a half hour is also good, or 20 minutes. Some of us make appointments in our calendar for these hours as if they're lunch meetings or business calls. 3. The kitchen timer hour. No phones, no texts. We silence ringers. We turn our phones face down. It is our life. We are entitled to 1 hour without interruption, particularly from loved ones. We ask for their support. I was on an hour is something they learn to understand, but they won't respect it unless we do first. No music with words unless it's a language we don't understand. Headphones with a white noise app can be helpful. No internet, absolutely. We turn off our computer's Wi-Fi. No reading. No pencil sharpening, desk tidying, organizing. 4. Immediately upon beginning the hour, we open two documents, our journal and the project we are working on. If we don't have a project we're actively working on, we just open our journal. 5. An hour consists of time spent keeping our writing appointment. That's it. We don't have to write at all if we are happy to stare at the screen or the page, nor do we have to write a single word on our current project. We may spend the entire hour writing in our journal. Anything we write in our journal is fine. Ideas for future projects, complaints about loved ones, what we ate for dinner, even I hate writing typed 400 times. When we wish or if we wish, we pop over to the current project document and write for as long as we like. When we get tired or want a break, we pop back to the journal. The point is, when disgust or fatigue with the current project arises, we don't take a break by getting up from our desk. We take a break by returning to the comforting arms of our journal until that in turn bores us. Then we are ready to write on our project again, and so on. We use our boredom in this way. It is always okay to write exclusively in our journal. In practice, it may rarely happen that we spend the full hour in our journal, but it's fine, good, and right if it does. It is just as good a writing day as one spent entirely in our current project. 6. It is infinitely better to write fewer hours every day than many hours one day and none the next. If we have a crowded weekend, we choose a half or quarter hour as our time, put in that time, and go on with our day. We are always trying to minimize our resistance, and beginning an hour on Monday after 2 days off is a challenge. 7. When the hour is up, we stop, even if we're in the middle of a sentence. If we have scheduled another hour, we give ourselves a break before beginning again, to read, eat, go on errands. We are not trying to create a cocoon we must stay in between hours, the old, I'm sorry, I can't see anyone or leave my house, I'm on a deadline method. Rather, inside the hour is the inviolate time. 8. If we fail to make our hours for the day, we have scheduled too many. 4 hours a day is an enormous amount of time spent in this manner. For example, if on Wednesday we plan to write 2 hours and didn't make it, we schedule a shorter appointment for the next day. We don't add an hour to make up or catch up. We let the past go and move on. 9. When we've fulfilled our commitment, we make sure we credit ourselves for doing so. We have satisfied our obligation to ourselves, and the rest of the day is ours to do with as we wish. 10. A word about content. This may seem to be all about form, but the knowledge that we have satisfied our commitment to ourselves, the freedom from anxiety and resistance, the stilling of that hectoring voice inside us that used to yell at us that we weren't writing enough, all this opens us up creatively. Good luck. Don Roos. Parenthood is the best neighborhood. Don't you hate it when one of your friends starts dating someone fabulous or gets a cool new job or an unexpected promotion, and they're so excited and happy, and they can't stop talking about how lucky they are and how amazing everything in their life is, and generally just won't shut up about it. That's what me telling you about the experience of doing the show Parenthood is going to be like. Lauren, please, you could never be as annoying as that, but allow me to try. We already know that I have a very special relationship that blossomed at work, which may seem like good fortune enough, but it doesn't stop there. I also fell in love with every other cast member there. As TV siblings, we didn't really resemble one another, but I so enjoyed the days we spent together and the dance parties on the set with Peter and Dax Shepard and Erica Christensen. My pretend in-laws Monica Potter and Joy Bryant and Sam Jaeger were, as people and actors, a fun and impressive bunch. The kids of Parenthood were gracious and sweet and smart, each and every one. Craig T. Nelson and Bonnie Bedelia were perfect as our fearless leaders. I grew up admiring their movies, so getting to work with them was even better. And I have a very special bond with my TV children, Mae Whitman and Miles Heiser. When we go out to eat, we still call it family dinner. I loved the writers and directors and my boss, Jason Kadams, who was the person responsible for establishing this wonderful environment in the first place. Our assistant directors, ADs, kept the schedule running smoothly and were kind and funny and pretended not to notice if I was late for my call time. Larry Trilling, one of our executive producers, is a guy I knew from college, and he became an even better friend at work. The whole place truly had a family feel. Our cameramen were also vital to the success of the show. They helped illuminate our work by focusing on behavior they found interesting. Someone's hands drumming nervously on a table, a subtle eye roll between spouses, Zeke puffing gleefully on his cigar. In most cases, our scenes were shot proscenium style, meaning the action took place on one plane, with two or three cameras filming across from us, almost as if we were on stage. This gave the actors an incredible amount of freedom, much more than a regular television setup allows, and it made room for a great deal of collaboration. Well, the people may have been great, but we've all watched enough Access Hollywood to know that the work hours that go into making a 60-minute show are grueling, right? Sorry, can't help you there. The hours on Parenthood were some of the best I've ever had. Within the excellent framework of the scripts we were given, we were also allowed some freedom with regard to dialogue. This meant we never got bogged down in having to do take after take, needing to say every single word exactly as written. This was especially helpful during our large family dinner scenes and added to the texture of what a big family sounds like, people talking over each other in a messy, authentic way. We were aided in this by the work of our excellent sound department. I had to go in and re-record a line maybe 3 times in 6 years, which is remarkably rare. In fact, everything ran so well, and we finished early on so many days that in our last 2 seasons, they actually cut a whole day out of our production on each episode, yet we still managed to finish at a reasonable hour. I wrote an entire book in my trailer during my free time. Monica Potter launched a beautiful line of home goods. Dax Shepard wrote and directed a film. Joy Bryant started a clothing line. Erica Christensen cycled 70 million miles across the city. We had satisfying jobs that also gave us room to grow, travel, and have lives. To an exceptional degree, there was thought and care put into our well-being. The catering was excellent. Some days we had a vegan chef, on other days a Hawaiian poke bar. There was a smoothie station and freshly baked cookies every day at lunch. Once in a while, we'd have an In-N-Out truck, awesome burgers, Koji truck, Roy Choi's tasty Korean fusion tacos, or Van Leeuwen artisanal ice cream cart as a special treat. There was a costume parade on Halloween, carol singers at Christmas, and on our last day of the year, a mariachi band during lunch to send us off. Harumph. This is somewhat irritating. They do not do these things at my job. But wait, there's more. As part of the season 5 finale, a few of us got to go to Hawaii and stay at the Four Seasons Hotel in Maui. Peter and Monica filmed for a few hours while I sipped Mai Tais by the pool. Okay, you're right. This is starting to be a little sickening. I'm not finished! Add to that the incredible stories we got to tell. Our show was about family and relationships, subjects that are about to become against the law on network television unless the family is also full of tattooed serial killer zombie firefighters who live in Chicago. Plus, I got to work not only with my incredible TV family, but also with fun guests like Billy Baldwin and Jason Ritter and Ray Romano. Which reminds me, I have a fear that I've already gone through all the tall actors in Hollywood and there may be none left to play my love interests in things. It's unusual to find very tall actors here. More of them than you might guess are really handsome shorties secretly standing on apple boxes. I'm 5'9", so this is a serious matter of career survival for me, and I'm afraid I've already worked with more than my fair share of guys I can literally look up to. Dax and Peter and Craig and Sam from Parenthood are all unusually tall. Scott Patterson and David Sutcliffe and Scott Cohen on Gilmore Girls could have started a basketball team. And Joel McHale, whom I did A Merry Friggin' Christmas with, is a hilarious and muscly giant whose massive arms could double as legs. How long can this lucky streak really continue? I think Liam Neeson might be the only suitably sized actor left. Talk about turning tables, Mr. Neeson. This time it is I who will be coming after you. Lauren, you've sort of gone off topic here. Ah, yes. Let me return to bragging. Like Gilmore Girls, Parenthood was another show that was a people are happy to see you at the airport show. It is an enjoyable perk of the job to see people's faces light up when they run into you, and maybe you get to hear a story of how something on your show reminded them of something good in their own lives. I wouldn't know, but I'm guessing this is preferable to them running away from you screaming, "Meth! Meth! So many years of meth!" I think I've had enough. Can you please just think of one negative thing to say about working there? Let me see. Oh, I know! The Universal lot is off Lancashire Boulevard, which is one exit farther from my house on the 101 freeway than Warner Brothers, where we shot Gilmore Girls. So it took me about 3 minutes longer to get to work in the morning. Oh, the hardship I endured with these people. See photo 18. Look up. A note from your friend, Old Lady Jackson. Old Lady Jackson is a character I made up when I started catching myself giving advice, initially to May and Miles on the Parenthood set, that sounded like it came from your gray-haired grandma who spends her days in a rocking chair knitting you scratchy socks you pretend to love at Christmas. By creating this character, who is obviously very, very, very far away from myself, I hope to confuse May and Miles, among others, into thinking that while I might sometimes seem to offer suggestions that could be considered a tad old-timey, they weren't actually coming from me. They were really coming from this weird, remote other persona, and I was actually still very hip and relevant and wore my L.L. Bean duck boots, ironically, and of course I knew who Tegan and Sarah were. But only because Miles made me a CD. When I started feeling older than my co-stars and other younger friends, some of whom were in their teens and early 20s, it was not in the normal ways I would have expected, like getting up from a chair and exclaiming, "Oi, my hip!" For me, it started when my mention of Happy Days was met with a blank stare, and I couldn't convince anyone that the AOL pager had ever been a thing. Because I live in Hollywood and am contractually bound never to age, instead of shouting, "Your generation doesn't understand anything," and stalking off to use the landline to call my answering service, I'd just roll my eyes and say, "I don't mean to sound like Old Lady Jackson here, but do you really want to post that picture of yourself in your underwear on Instagram?" As if to say, "Of course it's fine with me if you want to do that, because personal boundaries are so late 1990s, but someone way less cool who doesn't use Postmates to get their groceries delivered might think it's just a wee bit of an overshare." Old Lady Jackson isn't judgmental. She's just worried about you and wonders about things like your nose ring. Doesn't that hurt? And how can you possibly keep it clean? And that sixth tattoo you got isn't five enough. But not me, no siree. I'm proud of you for expressing yourself. One morning in the Gilmore Girls makeup trailer, during the first series, I was prattling on to Alexis about the possibility of getting a tattoo and the exciting potential of designing it myself because, I explained, that's where the real fun was, the real artistry. I could just picture my new tattooed life. I'd be out at some cool club or bar, assuming that along with my new tattoo, I had also started going to cool clubs and bars for the first time ever, and some hot dude in a biker jacket would catch my eye and appreciatively check me out, and what better conversation opener, what more sure path to lifelong happiness and true bliss than, "Cool, tat, did you design that yourself?" After I went on and on about my fantasy post-tattoo life for a while, Alexis smiled and gently said, "So what would you get? A shamrock?" No. I mean, what? No. A sham... Please. That's just silly. Why would you think I'd get something as predictable as a sham... Oh, dear, how embarrassing. You're right. I'm a cliche of a somewhat Irish person. But hey, it's not like I was going to put it on my ankle, so at least there's, oh, fine, okay, yes, that's exactly where I was going to put it. After my embarrassment faded, I realized I didn't want a tattoo anymore. Why? Because through her more mature eyes, I suddenly saw the inherent futility of it. All at once, it was like I'd done it already, experienced a brief thrill, lived with it for a couple of years, and eventually woke up one day and felt like, huh, what a weird thing that was for me to do. Sometimes the idea of doing something is the most fun part, and after you go through with it, you feel deflated because you realize you're back to looking for the next thrill. Often, waiting reveals the truth about something, and not responding to your every impulse can save you the heartache of waking up in the morning with a sense of regret after having impulsively texted that guy at 2 a.m. because you just had to tell him about the funny skit you just watched on SNL. And it's not like you want to date him or anything, and you'd only had one glass of wine, or was it two? But in any case, he was probably up anyway. Don't press send, old Lady Jackson is fond of counseling. Just wait a beat. Talking about getting a tattoo was, I realized, a perfect case of life being about the journey and not the destination. And I felt relieved to have saved myself from reaching my destination with a lot of tattoos on my upper butt area that I then changed my mind about. One of the best things about old Lady Jackson is that when you don't take her advice, Miles and May have approximately 7,000 piercings between them and exactly 152 tattoos each, it's fine with me. She's no fun, but I still am. Old Lady Jackson is concerned about you in other ways, too, but I think you're doing great. OLJ is obviously overly worried about things like that dating app that wants you to have your location services on all the time. How is that possibly safe? And the fact that all you ate yesterday were liquids that came in mason jars from that juice place on the corner. Really? No solid foods at all? OLJ doesn't love it when that guy texts you at 11 o'clock on a Friday night after you haven't heard from him all week and wants you to hang out, and you do. She's worried that you aren't being treated as well as you deserve, and while she understands that things are different now, surely there have to still be people out there with better manners and an ability to make plans with you at least a day or two ahead of time. Old Lady Jackson is also very worried about the alarming number of young people she's heard are being prescribed Adderall so that they can focus better at school or work. In OLJ's day, they called the feeling of not wanting to sit in the library for hours the feeling of not wanting to sit in the library for hours. And it wasn't considered a medical condition to be bored or distracted at work. It was just part of the reality of work. A while ago, I saw a young family in the airport, a couple, with their young toddler, who was happily sitting in her carrying chair thing. All three were looking down, scrolling through their phones with glassy eyes, not speaking to one another. We see this a lot, of course, but this was the first time it really occurred to me how different things are now than when I grew up. I didn't have a mobile phone until I was in my late 20s. My 14-year-old godson just got one not too long ago. But the next generation, like this baby in the airport, we'll never know what life is like without a device. This raises a couple of questions. What does the future hold for this baby? And can she already beat me a Candy Crush? We can all agree that airports are the worst and a tough place to entertain a fussing baby. And presumably the parents were doing something important and would return their attention to each other and their baby in a moment. Probably the baby was sitting there learning to speak Mandarin or monitoring her stock portfolio. Even so, there's a checked-out, drugged sort of look we get when on our phones that's different from the look we get when reading a book or even just staring into space. I get that look, too, and when I catch my own reflection, it gives me a chill. It's like Gollum's face, just before he drops his precious in the water. The people I know who use social media and dating apps do so because they're trying to connect, stay in touch, and in some cases find someone to go out with or maybe even to fall in love and start a family with. In fact, this family in the airport was quite possibly formed by these advances in technology, and now, thanks to the wondrous connectivity to which we all have access, they had finally achieved their dream of finding each other. But they were still sitting in the airport, scrolling through their phones. And this is just the beginning. Where will we go from here? When my sister meets her work friends for dinner, a group of super high-level New York business types, they sometimes do the following. Everyone places their cell phone in the center of the dinner table, and the first one who can't take it anymore and goes to reach for their phone has to pay the bill. Fun! When I'm driving somewhere, I've started to put my purse in the trunk of the car to prevent myself from checking my phone at a stoplight. I think games like this are necessary until we figure out how else to resist the temptation to click on important breaking news stories while driving, like 10 cats with surprisingly human faces. Or rather, I think it's probably all fine. Let's make a date to see each other and then spend 20 minutes scrolling through hundreds of photos looking for that one we just can't find. Let's not wonder about one single solitary thing when we can just Google it over appetizers. Let's leave our phones out on the table in case of emergency, but respond to all the non-emergency texts anyway. It's just what people do. I'm totally okay with it. It's that crazy old lady Jackson who thinks it's weird, and she wrote you a letter on actual paper to give you her thoughts. My dearies, I miss car keys. Those unattractive fob blobs they use now don't hang well on my keychain, and my gentleman friend is always forgetting to give them to the valet. What? You think old Lady Jackson doesn't have the occasional suitor to escort her to a nice sushi dinner once in a while? Please, please, sit down. No, not there, dear. That's for company. Have a cookie. You're too thin. Is it cold in here? What was that? Speak up, dear. I won't keep you long. I know you're busy. Let me tell you a story. One day, that horrible Marion from next door invited me to one of those group online thingies where we keep track of our steps and see who has the most. You know those? You do. Of course you do. Well, for a few weeks I participated, and I thought it was the most wonderful thing. Such a sense of accomplishment at day's end. So I started counting absolutely everything and got all these wonderful apps. I counted not just how many steps I took, but also how many hours I slept, how many calories I ate, how many followers I had on Facebook, what the weather was like in Hawaii, how my retirement stocks were doing. I got a countdown app to remind me how many days I had left to shop for my nephew's birthday. I got an app to track the constellations in the sky, an app to record how much money I spend at Starbucks, an app to remind me to water my plants, another that reminds me when to order more contact lenses, and one that tells me how many times I've listened to Doris Day sing Que Sera, Sera this week. Isn't progress wonderful? I got an app to read what everyone thinks of restaurants, too. This one was confusing to me because it seems every single restaurant in the country is just horrible. But anyway, I especially loved the Steps app because I could look at the thingy marker, and if Marion was getting ahead of me, it would make me jump out of my chair and wave my arms around to get my count higher. I beat her so many days that I could almost forget all the time she hid my trash bins and stole my Sunday paper. Bliss. Then my gentleman friend and I were home one night drinking prune juice with vodka and binge-watching the Waltons, and apparently I was getting up to check my phone more times than you can say goodnight, Jim Bob. Finally, my gentleman friend paused the VHS tape right on John Boy's face and asked me what it was that was distracting me, and I told him it wasn't at all that I was distracted. I was just excited by all the wonderful new information that was coming in, and did he want to see the weather in Hawaii or join our step club too? No, he said, he didn't. And then he asked me a question. Why? He said. What was I going to do with all this information? Why keep track of so many things? And why did I keep marching around the living room waving my arms over my head? What did it all mean at the end of a day, or the end of a life, for that matter? When you're our age, you think about these things, dear, but don't worry yourself about it just now. You're still younger than you think. Anyway, everything suddenly went topsy-turvy, and I had to sit back down on the Davenport. Have another cookie while they're warm, won't you? My story is almost over. I had to sit down because I suddenly realized what a waste of time it all was. I take my walk every morning, rain or shine. Who cares if Marion goes a little farther? I water my plants when the soil looks dry, and I haven't forgotten my nephew's birthday once ever. In fact, I started to think about my nephew and all the time he uses that phone, always checking for likes on that Instacart. It's good to be bored in the car, I always tell him. Spend some time with just yourself and your thoughts and nothing to do. How else will you learn who you are? I'm worried about your posture, dear. I'm concerned that it comes from all the looking down, what with your phone and the Xbox and the taxi TV and that music player you wear on your arm and the headphones that look like donuts on your ears. Doesn't it make life so much smaller? If absolutely everything important is only happening on such a small screen, isn't that a shame? Especially when the world is so overwhelmingly large and surprising. Are you missing too much? You can't imagine it now, but you'll look like me one day, even though you'll feel just the same as you do now. You'll catch a glimpse of yourself in the mirror and think how quickly it's all gone. And I wonder if all the time you used watching those families whose lives are filmed for the television and making those cartoons of yourselves with panting dog tongues and chasing after that terrible Pokemon fellow. Well, will it feel like time well spent? Here lies Ms. Jackson. She took more steps than the other old biddies on her road. Is that the best I can leave behind? Is it all just designed to keep us looking down, or to give us the illusion that we have some sort of control over our chaotic lives? Will you do me a small favor, dears, and look up? Especially you New Yorkers and Londoners and other city dwellers who cross all those busy streets. How else will you take in the majesty of the buildings that have stood there for hundreds of years? How else will you run into an acquaintance on the street who might turn into a friend or a lover, or even just recommend a good restaurant that no one has complained about on that app yet? If you never look out the window of the subway car, how will you see the boats gliding by on the East River, or have an idea that only you could have? Just look up for no reason, just for a moment here and there, or maybe for an entire day once in a while. Let the likes go unchecked and the quality of sleep go unnoticed. Que sera, sera, my dears. Whatever will be, will be, whether we're tracking it on our GPS devices or not. Look up. Look up. What you see might surprise you. Love, Old Lady Jackson. What It Was Like, Part 2. Spoiler alert! The following contains plot and casting mentions and some general information you may not want to have until after you've seen the new episodes. If you haven't watched Gilmore Girls, A Year in the Life yet, you might want to skip this part until you have. Years from now, long after the Downton Abbey reboot, Matthew Lives, the 6 Feet Under reboot, literally The Walking Dead, and the reboot of the Fuller House reboot, don't be rude, cut it out, all over again. I'll still be trying to explain what it was like to return to Gilmore Girls. That was the first question I got when the show was announced, and the one I've been asked most frequently ever since. It's also a question I don't feel I've quite answered satisfactorily. So far, I've just stuttered and stammered and tried to find something to compare it to. It's like getting a chance to go to college all over again, but this time you know what classes to take, and you know how to really appreciate all the classes and the people, and no, that's not what it was like. It's like if you got back together with an old boyfriend, but now there were only the good parts about him, without all the stuff that bugged you, and you got to fall in love all over again without making any of the mistakes you made when you, no, that's not it either. It's like if you were diagnosed with a disease, but then the doctors realized they'd made a mistake and you were actually okay, so you experienced the feeling of enjoying every day that much more because suddenly you'd been reminded how precious the days were, and you were even more thankful to have them because you'd been faced with the reality of how rare they actually are, when before you'd taken the days for granted and thought you were sick, but you're not, and no. I have an old email from Amy from December 2014, where she mentions the possibility of taking a pitch out to some streaming services. That must mean that we'd already had our lunch at the Greek restaurant in Los Angeles, where she first told me some of her ideas and started sketching out the early plot lines. Inspired by the British series Sherlock, which has no yearly set number of episodes, but instead does anywhere from 1 to 4 specials, she envisioned 4 mini-movies that would run about 90 minutes each. At that lunch, she asked if I'd read the Marie Kondo book, The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying Up. Yes, I had, I replied. She also kept asking me if I'd read Wild and or seen the movie. Yes to both, I told her, and why was she asking? We hadn't seen each other in a while, and the reality of getting back together to do the show again seemed so far away, which meant we kept getting distracted and going off on tangents, and she never really answered me about either. What she was mainly there to ask me was, if it was possible to somehow put this thing together, would I be interested? Why, yes. Yes, I would be. A few months later, in early spring of 2015, Amy and Dan felt we were inching closer to the reality of making the show at Netflix, but we were still too far away to make any formal announcement. Warner Brothers and Netflix had to agree to a deal first, and then Amy and Dan would go in and pitch the story ideas. Or was it the other way around? Would it be better to pitch the ideas first, then see if everyone could make a deal? This was all new territory. The two entities would be paying for the show, and they had to make nice with each other first, and that process was complicated. The existence of streaming was new, rebooting a show on a different network was new, and turning a show that once had been an hour long, minus time for commercials, into uninterrupted 90-minute movies was new. And notice that no one was even talking about the actors yet. This could all take a while. The Green Eggs and Ham deal took 18 months, Amy told me. 18 months? Also, they're making Green Eggs and Ham into a movie? Anyway, I knew we didn't have that much time, in part because of the backlot. The backlot. Oy. You've heard of the town of Stars Hollow? Well, I'm here to tell you, it is real. It's a wonderful, happy place with cheerful neighbors, ballerinas taking classes at Miss Patty's, and a seasonal festival of some sort happening in the town square. It's a place where the coffee flows freely, junk food has no calories, and Kirk has somehow found yet another job. There, the town meeting might be in session, although I'm usually late for it, with Taylor Dozy presiding, and outside, near the gazebo, there could be a hay bale maze set up for your enjoyment. It's a place where, on one special day every year, I smell snow. If that's where you'd like to leave your understanding of our beloved town, please skip what's to come. Because sometimes it's also a place in Los Angeles on the Warner Brothers lot where other people from other shows come to visit, and sometimes they stay for a while, occasionally for years. Shockingly, it turned out that no one had reserved that spot for us indefinitely and held it frozen in time in the event of our triumphant return. Lots of other shows needed the backlot around the same dates we needed it, so we'd been given a very narrow time frame in which to use it. Obviously, when you're returning to Stars Hollow, you have to have an actual Stars Hollow. But the reality of the scheduling was that if we couldn't find a way to start filming by February 2016, basically, we wouldn't be filming at all. In March 2015, with everything still very much up in the air, we were invited to the ATX Festival in Austin, Texas, for a Gilmore Girls reunion. In my emails with Amy from that time, we discussed where to stay in Austin, the St. Cecilia, our shared eye doctor, Dr. Sachs, and theater, Hand of God, so good, and no, even back then, you couldn't get Hamilton tickets. We also discussed the many rumors that were flying around. I heard the deal was getting close. I heard the deal was falling apart. Scott Patterson went on a podcast and mentioned there were talks, which had basically been true since the day the show ended in 2007, but the comment caught fire and people thought he knew more than he was saying, when in fact, none of us did. A few weeks after the festival, I got a call from my agent saying that he'd finally heard Netflix had committed to making 8 to 10 episodes of our show. Great news! I emailed Amy, who said she'd heard no such thing. In the meantime, Amy's mysterious questions continued. She asked me if I knew fellow Barnard alum Janine Tesori, and I said I didn't, but I loved her musical, Fun Home, with all my heart. Amy told me she was having back trouble and wondered if I'd ever had back trouble. She asked me if, on the old show, I remembered asking her to write the longest monologue that had ever been done on TV. Our scripts back then had averaged 85 pages when most one-hour shows are under 50 pages, but still, I wanted more. Anyway, there were many emails going back and forth. We kept trying to meet for drinks, but plans kept moving. I forgot I had tickets to Fish in the Dark and other New York City scheduling problems. And I started getting confused as to which of her inquiries was regarding real life and which might be potential Gilmore plot lines. Does Lorelai deliver a long monologue about straining her back while listening to the works of Janine Tesori as she cleans out her closet wearing hiking boots? I wasn't sure. Then one day, out of the blue, there was a press release that said Netflix would indeed carry the new episodes, 4 90-minute movies. This was exciting, but news to practically everyone. Alexis, Kelly, Scott, and I had been involved in these casual conversations for months, and I'd had all those mysterious questions from Amy, of course, but suddenly it was real. Or more accurately, suddenly Warner Brothers and Netflix had been able to make a real deal with each other to make movies that needed to start filming in under 2 months and which had no sets built and zero actors formally attached. Fun! Sean Gunn posted a picture of himself on Twitter next to the announcement on his computer. He looked completely surprised, because he was. Amy and I spoke on the phone, and I congratulated her, us? But weeks after you were already excited about watching it, and I was being congratulated on being in it, no one had yet called me about actually doing it. Plus, I was in Atlanta by then, filming the movie Middle School, which had months left to go, and as far as I could tell, the filming schedules totally conflicted. Was anyone else worried about this? It seemed no one was. Finally, one day, the phone rang. Deal-making in Hollywood is a fun and straightforward process where everyone puts their cards on the table and then proceeds like proper ladies and gentlemen to respectfully agree to terms and sums of money that are fair to both sides is a sentence that has never before been written. Let me attempt to explain how it really happens. Negotiating in Hollywood is like dating a horrible guy whom you have to keep seeing because he is in charge of your paycheck. In order to get your money from him, you will have to put up with a lot of crap and pretend to enjoy it. Once he pays you, you can break up with him, but only until the next time you need him, at which time you'll have to pretend to be in love with him all over again and act as if you have no memory of the past. Paycheck Boyfriend does not return your phone calls, or else calls you only at weird times when he knows you can't talk. He compares you to other hotter girls he's dated and finds you lacking, dismisses your past accomplishments, and makes sure you know he has 25 other people he can call to go to dinner with him. You have earned this treatment by being very successful. Aren't you lucky? The problem is that if Paycheck Boyfriend treats you better, you might want him to pay you more, and he really, really, really doesn't want to do that. It's not entirely Paycheck Boyfriend's fault either, because he himself has a corporate Paycheck Boyfriend who is treating him even worse, who cares mostly about how the stock of whatever company owns the studio is doing, and doesn't understand why drones can't star in TV shows instead of actors, since they are just as talented but have less body fat. Why can't we do a show starring the self-driving Google car? CPB is fond of asking. It seems insane to me now, but the truth is that up until about a week before filming started, the reality of making the show was still very much up in the air. So many pieces had to come together. So many people's schedules had to align. Some actors weren't approached at all until after filming had actually started, because the days and weeks leading up to that first day were so chaotic. Plus, we have a cast that numbers in the hundreds. Among other oddities, this meant I had almost no time to prepare or to process the fact that I was going back to the character I'd loved so much. Maybe that's why so much of the show had such a surreal quality. But in the beginning, I was just relieved not to be negotiating anymore. To let you all know it was really happening, I tweeted this photo. See photo 19. The caption read, "I can now confirm. It's time for me and this jacket I stole in 2007 to return to work. By the way, stealing is wrong. Unless it's fun material for your book, then it's okay." You'd think that all those years of being asked about the possibility of making a movie would have prepared me for finally doing one or four. But we'd spent 7 years without a real possibility, over a year with only a vague one, and then a flurry of a few weeks in which major decisions had to be made, and suddenly everything was a go. Even though I knew it was real, in a way, I don't know if my brain ever quite caught up to the reality of what was happening. I still sort of can't believe it happened. It happened, right? I have honestly never had an experience like it. For starters, I was very, very emotional the whole time. I don't usually cry easily, but throughout the days and months of filming, I welled up a lot. I've told the story before about how Alexis was so green when we first started and our walk and talks so lengthy and complex that I'd sometimes put my arm through hers to help guide her to our mark. But the first day we returned to Lorelai's house, it was me who reached for her arm for support. I was so overwhelmed that I felt a little shaky. And then there was the day I walked onto the grand Gilmore House stage for the first time. It wasn't just emotional because it had been recreated. It was also genuinely sad because Ed Herman had passed away the previous winter. You know how some people have such a big presence, they just fill up a room. You might enter, and before you even see them, you know they're there. That was Ed. His presence was as tall and warm as he was. So his absence had a feeling, too. The room was entirely different without his booming voice and easy laugh. Kelly spoke to him that first day on set. "Ed, we know you're here. We miss you," she said, and everyone choked up. Those tears made sense, but some of my other teary reactions were just bizarre. For example, when Chris Eigeman, a dear friend, came to do his cameo, we sat down for a casual rehearsal, and as we started to read through our scene, I could not manage to get through my first line. "Why, Jason Styles, as I live and breathe." Normally, saying hello to someone in the beginning of a scene is not the emotional high point for the character or the actor. I was just so happy to see him again. My normal state of happy to see someone does not usually involve tears, but on this show, tissues were being handed to me a lot. In another scene, I had trouble getting through the simple sentence, "My name is Lorelai Gilmore, and I'm from a little town in Connecticut." All I'm doing in that scene is giving some strangers basic information. Still, for some reason, tears. I guess I was overwhelmingly happy to get to say her name again. For the reboot, all the sets had to be reconstructed, which also contributed to the surreal quality. No one had saved any set pieces from the old show, because why would they have? Netflix didn't exist when the show ended, and no one had any concrete reason to believe we'd be back in the Gilmore House or Luke's Diner or Stars Hollow ever again. There was no gazebo on the backlot anymore. They had to build one. There were no precise measurements of the rooms either, so while sets were reconstructed as closely as possible, in most cases the measurements were slightly off. This added to the eerie quality of being back. In the Gilmore House, for example, the foyer was completely familiar, yet just a little bit larger than it was in the original. Everything was the same, yet brand new. I noticed the slight changes because I knew these spaces as intimately as if it were a real house I'd actually lived in for years. We were back in the Warner Brothers lot as we had been the first time around, but all the stages that housed our sets were in different places. It was a constant surprise to walk out of Lorelai's house and run into friends who work on the Ellen show, because previously we hadn't been anywhere near Ellen. But on the other hand, because certain sets were so familiar, I'd sometimes lose track of where I was in time. For several fleeting moments every day, I'd think I was still doing the old show, until something from the present would remind me the time had passed. Then there was El Nino. Given how tight our time was on the backlot, we couldn't afford to lose any days there, but huge storms were predicted, and lots of rain. There aren't many cloudy days in a town like Stars Hollow, so we were worried, and we waited. But not only did it not storm, the weather played its part during the seasonal episodes, as though it too had been cast in the show. When we were filming summer, it was balmy. Fall had a bit of crisp in the air. In spring, breezes lifted us up, and during winter, we had an unseasonable chill. For usually predictable Southern California, this was nothing short of magical. And the predicted El Nino storms, they didn't happen. Throughout it all, the emotion I felt most was gratitude. I treasured every experience and savored every scene in a way that was different from when I did the original show. Partially this had to do with being in a different place personally and professionally. I wasn't new to the business anymore, and I had a much more acute sense of how lucky I was to be part of this cast and crew. I treasured the chance to speak words written by the Paladinos once more, and I now understood in greater depth how rare it was to have had the opportunity to be part of something this special in the first place. In the flurry of the first incarnation, it was hard to have much perspective. This time, I was thankful for every single day. We were also buoyed by the enthusiasm we felt from all of you. Normally, when actors start a new show, we have no idea if what we're doing will work or if people will like it. To know we were making something that at least some people were already very excited about seeing was a thrilling novelty, and your support was a big part of what made every day feel special. Thank you so much for that. After all those years of having no answer when asked by you and Mike Osiello about the possibility of a Gilmore Girls movie, finally, I had something to say. And that we'd landed at Netflix was an honor, too. Executives usually walk around looking jumpy, but these Netflix and Warner Brothers execs were happy and smiling throughout it all. "We knew it was big, but we had no idea it was this big," they said. Everyone was excited and proud. So, what was it like? The truth is, it was so many things at once that there is no short way to describe it, no soundbite that does it justice. But I did keep a diary of sorts, which I wish I'd done the first time around, to try to cut through how overwhelming much of it was, and to have a record I could look back on when it was done, to see if that could help me process the whole experience. Here are just a few of the most memorable days of filming Gilmore Girls, A Year in the Life. Tuesday, February 2nd, 2016. It's the first day of filming. As I said, we had very little time between, "Are we doing this?" and, "Wow, we're doing this!" Plus, I was on location in Atlanta until less than a week before Gilmore Girls filming was supposed to start. So while normally I'd have had a bunch of fittings with Brenda, the costume designer, and we'd have planned at least the early round of outfits, in this case we had time for just one fitting and had chosen only a handful of looks. The morning is a bit of a scramble, as they usually are. The first scene we're filming is not the first scene you see, but it is a piece of the opening sequence. So basically, I'm choosing the outfit for the first time you see Lorelai, and I keep fussing over what it should be. Whatever we chose already just doesn't seem right to me today for some reason, so I ask for more choices. "Just bring a bunch of tops and let me mess around a little," I say to Sesha, my on-set dresser. Sesha and I worked together for all 7 years on the first show, so she knows what that means. She loads up a rolling rack with a ton of stuff. I keep trying things on and taking them off. Nothing feels right. A knock on my door tells me the cameras are ready, so I pull a blue blouse off its hanger. When in doubt, blue! It's a little big, so Sesha pins it in the back for me. Then I jump on my bicycle and speed to set. I like to have a bike to ride to and from set, rather than take the van they usually provide. Sometimes those short moments in between setups are the only ones I have to myself during a long day, and I like to get even that short burst of exercise. The bicycle I'm using is brand new, a light green bike that was the wrap gift from Parenthood. Our boss, Jason Kadams, gave one to every member of the cast and crew. Nice. The bikes all came with license plates that say Braverman. I looked at the license plate on the first day and wondered if I should take it off. Would I get confused and start wondering where Hank was? But I decided it was nice to bring a little Sarah along for the ride. I pedal to set and get touched up. Right before we start rolling, I feel an itch on the back of my neck. Maybe one of the safety pins Sesha used to pin the shirt is poking through. Sesha realizes that in my haste to get dressed, I didn't take the tags out. She snips them off and we start the scene. The first day is full of happy, smiling faces. One of my favorites to see back is George, our dialogue coach. After we run lines, he talks about last night's American Idol and reminds me how we used to love dishing about it back in the day. I remember being awed by Kelly Clarkson then, whom I've since been lucky enough to meet. We talk about how funny and perfect it is that AI is in its final season, and now we'll get a chance to chat about the contestants again one last time. The day goes smoothly, and it's truly bizarre how easy it is to get back in the groove I left behind all those years ago. At the end of the day, Sesha knocks on my trailer door. She has a funny look on her face. "I want to show you something," she says. "I swear I didn't see this before." She hands me a small piece of cardboard, and for a moment, it doesn't quite compute. "What is this?" I ask her. "It's the tag from the shirt you wore this morning," she says. "I cut it off earlier, but I didn't look at it until just now." I glance at the tag again, and this time I gasp. I wouldn't believe it if I hadn't seen it, and neither would you. So here it is. See photo number 20. Can you believe it? Okay, the spelling of the name is one letter off, but the shirt has the name, and it's my character's name. And it's not just called The Lorelai, which would be coincidence enough, but it's called The Lorelai, too. And it's our very first day, and it's the second time I'm playing Lorelai, and it's... Okay, you get it. Sesha and I look at each other, eyes wide. I wonder if I've fallen into some sort of magical fairy omen land. At the very least, I take it as an incredible sign of good things to come. I tape it up on the wall over the sink in my trailer to remind me every day that strange and wonderful magic might be in store. Wednesday, February 10th. Yannick and I have a scene at the Dragonfly where he's upset that all the A-list actors in town to shoot a movie are staying at a rival inn, and the Dragonfly is stuck with the B-list actors. It culminates with him moaning, "We will never bag Jennifer Lawrence, and what's the point of living if you can't bag Jennifer Lawrence?" Yannick's Michelle has always been a terrific comedic character, but in this series, he gets to really shine, and we had a wonderful time in our scenes together. Then Paul Anka, the person, not the dog, arrives to be in Lorelai's anxiety dream. He, the person, not the dog, is hilarious and professional, and he looks like a million bucks. Although we've worked together before, I get weirdly shy around him and out of nowhere ask him how many kids he has. Like, we weren't talking about kids or anything related to them. He probably just said he had a great pasta at lunch, and I replied, "How many kids do you have?" What a weirdo. Thursday, February 11th. President Obama is a guest on the Ellen DeGeneres Show today, and the lot is in a security tizzy. I'm called in earlier than needed in case they jam all the cell phones. They can do that? We're shooting the scene where Lorelai tells Luke she's going away to do Wild, the book, not the movie. I say the line, I know, 13 times, but it's an oddly emotional scene, the beginning of a big journey for Luke and Lorelai. Friday, February 12th. Dax Shepard is in the hair and makeup trailer. Worlds collide. He's getting a haircut from one of the stylists he knows who's working with us and drinking a green juice in preparation for starring in Chips, which he also wrote and directed. Not only is he obviously some sort of genius, but his already non-existent body fat has gone down